Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour, continuing with our ongoing series, Conversations with Remarkable Minds. Today, the topic is capitalism and neoliberal globalization, structural violence, and genocidal nature against human societies and the environment. I'm looking forward towards alternative emergent economies. My guest is Gary Leach. Gary Leach is the director of the Center for International Studies and a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Cape Breton University in Nova Scotia, Canada. He is an independent journalist, an author, a scholar, and he's focused his energies on the global struggle for social justice and on the U.S. intervention in Colombia under the war on drugs and on the war on terror. His articles have appeared in numerous publications around the world. He has over 350 scholarly articles, and he was also a founding editor of the Columbia Journal. He's the author of 7 books dealing with Colombia, the drug trade, broader critiques of capitalist globalization, and the influence of the fossil industry on global economics and politics. His most recent work is Capitalism, a Structural Genocide, which takes an honest look at how contemporary capitalism's inherent and fundamental structure generates inequality and violence and increased human suffering and death. His website is garryleech.com. Nice to have you with us again today, Gary.
Thank you for having me again.
This is a serious show. I believe that we have let all the adults out of the room in our society when it comes to our media. What we have in its place are people who bear more of the characteristics of sociopaths or narcissists than anything else. People who are pleading for us to believe in them and their agenda, their ideology, their political or religious tolerances, and we're supposed to be an extension of that. So when you listen to Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin, any Bill O'Reilly, who calls himself an independent, far from it, in my opinion, Sean Hannity, and all the others who support a corporate conservative and Republican perspective, they're challenging those on the so-called left, but not the left of FDR, not the left of many of the true progressives or liberals in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, who weren't corporatists. These are the Clinton and Obama corporate liberal and Democrats, Rachel Maddow, and all the others and that are on MSNBC, and many are on Pacifica Radio as well, what I call the limousine liberals. So left out of the discussions on everything that's a problem and everything that's a solution are the true progressives, the Chris Hedges, the Rabbi Michael Lerners, the people who have unique perspectives that could help us get ahead of where we're at now. And so that's why we invited you. That's why we do this program, because I'm just amazed at the level that we have lowered ourselves to. The latest thing is yesterday they announced a new reality show where they put people in the wilderness for 21 days with nothing and they're supposed to survive, but they have to do it naked. Now, why naked? I'm sure that some producer thought we'll get more people watching it if they're naked. And what do they do after that? Remember, we're now in a hyper-distracted society. We're more like a nation of cockroaches on speed. We are addicted, much like a meth addict is, to constant distraction. And as a result, we tire quickly. We reach a threshold and saturate our interest, and then immediately demand more, more violence, more sex, more whatever it is. And there are always people willing to provide us with that, as if somehow Oprah ever really provided what people needed for change. I don't believe so. I have my own particular point of view on people that exploit people's weaknesses, needs. But at the end of it all, it's all about them. We now have a society where everything is about the individual or the corporation that the individual is a part of or the board of directors or the power group at the head of a corporation or the head of a media, who green light which things happen to us, or red light which things don't happen. They create the laws through ALEC at the state level. The American Legislative Exchange Council has created over 20,000 laws. So yet we never knew they created any laws until a year and a half ago when they were finally exposed after 35 years in existence, representing the top 300 multinational corporations. We thought state legislators created laws that protected us. We were wrong. We believe that the Supreme Court was the ultimate judiciary for standing up for the Constitution. We were wrong. They allowed Citizens United, which meant that the biggest, most powerful can buy elections. Anyone can buy an election today. It's perfectly legal. We thought that there would be people who would truly seek ways of understanding how we live in balance with nature. We were wrong. The exploitation of nature and its resources to an appetite that can never be satiated by the average person, because we're trained to believe that our only purpose in life is to consume. And our jobs then are relegated to allowing us to consume at a certain level. When we can't consume anything else, then we're given access to debt with credit cards and liar loans so we can continue consuming. Where is there a rebalance? There is not. We were told not to worry about nature, and we didn't. So we built homes on mountains where we shouldn't have had them, in woods where they would burn down, near the ocean where they would flood, in the middle of deserts where tornadoes would rip them apart, where earthquake faults would be always a reminder of how precarious our situation. We were told the banking system had our interests at stake. Now we realize that they have only their own. We were told that our White House would bail us out. They've not bailed a single person out, but they have helped all those people that caused the mess. They no longer have to hide their biases. We were told that our children come first, then we exploit our children by having epidemics of type 1 diabetes from vaccines, epidemics of type 2 diabetes from the food we consume in our children and adults. One-third of all of us are overweight. We spend more on health care and have crappy health care, that we spend a lot for it. So everywhere you look, someone is jumping out of college and rushing off to Wall Street or any place else where they can get their hand in that honey pot. So that's where we begin our journey today. That said, I asked for a full hour with you so we would not have to rush, because I believe you have a great deal to give us as a way of insight into these circumstances. We've been told that every problem we have, from unemployment to gross poverty, to crime, to ghettoization of our suburban areas and rural areas and our urban areas, all can be fixed with a free market. Just let the free market speak. But we heard this before from Alan Greenspan. We hear it now from his successor, the Ayn Rand wannabe, in the form of our current head of Federal Reserve. And now, potentially the worst of all, is Larry Summers becoming the head of that. When we had you on the Noon program last week, I had you begin with providing us with an overview for a rationale to identify capitalism's inherent structure as being violent and genocidal, something you never hear discussed in the media. We discussed your analysis that capitalism kills about 10 million people a year around the world. Therefore, since that time that the World Trade Organization and trade agreements like NAFTA and TRIPS went into effect, we're looking at approximately 150 million dead individuals from the capitalist system. And then we spoke about the need for an international redefinition of genocide to account for the kinds of violence being inflicted on people throughout the world by a runaway globalization of capital and multinational corporate interest. I'd like to begin today from a different angle, leading into capitalism's destructive nature. We often hear criticisms about our global economy coming from different directions. We hear terms such as laissez-faire economy, neoliberal free market, free trade, free market fundamentalism, or there are the battles between Keynesian, Hayek, the Austrian school, and others. But all these fall under one single umbrella known as capitalism. So while we hear these other terms tossed around as the cause of the world's and the nation's economic woes, we rarely hear that it is capitalism that has become the fundamental economic and social problem. So please begin by addressing the question about why we are afraid to challenge the true definition of capitalism and evaluate its worth and value on its own terms, And in your answer, please tie this into the genocidal nature of capitalism that you and some other political scientists and economists have identified. Take your time. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Guy. As you said, we hear terms such as free market all the time, laissez-faire capitalism, and the neoliberal globalization process is supposed to be promoting that model. But as you also mentioned, we've seen our governments bail out the banks, the auto industry, and provide many subsidies to corporations. And this seems like a contradiction. A fundamental contradiction, because laissez-faire capitalism surely means less government intervention in the economy. And I would argue that neoliberalism, this model of globalization, this corporate globalization that we're living through, particularly for the last 30 years, isn't about free markets at all. I would argue that the logic of capitalism is to accumulate capital, to generate as much profit as possible, which becomes new capital to reinvest, and as such, capitalism expands, corporations expand, constantly seeking to produce more, and so we can consume more. Now, capital, the corporations, will accept any conditions that allow them to fulfill this logic, to accumulate profits and capital. So therefore, if a government will bail them out when they're in crisis, they'll accept a bailout. I didn't see a single CEO of any Wall Street investment bank say, no, we won't take the bailouts because we believe in free market capitalism. Because the reality is they don't. They want less regulation and free markets if that suits their allows them to accumulate capital. But the minute government regulations or subsidies or bailouts or intervention of any kind better facilitates that, they will accept that. So the whole process, the globalization process we're living through today, is our governments and international institutions such as the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, creating favorable conditions for corporations to accumulate more profits and more capital, which they then reinvest, and the cycle continues. And yes, that is fundamentally the logic of capitalism. And as you said, Gary, we don't hear that word much in our society. We are educated in school. We listen to the news on the media. And you rarely ever hear that word. It's just the economy. We hear the economy. We're led to believe that the economy is this natural thing that's just naturally evolving. And we can't do much about it. We've just got to adapt to it. But it's not. It's an ideologically motivated system that serves certain interests. And in the words of the Occupy movement, that is the interest of the 1%, those who own the economy and dominate it. And it's interesting, since 2008, the financial crisis, we are seeing some mention of capitalism, even penetrating the mainstream media a little bit. People have become more conscious of the word now. And the reason that the elites who run our economy and our government don't like to use the term capitalism, because it implies then if this is one particular type of economy, then there must be other types out there, rather than it just being the natural economy. And so we're seeing a shift, though, as people are responding and starting to realize that it is capitalism itself that is flawed, that the model is not working for most people. We've seen that with the Occupy movement. We've seen it with Idle No More. And we're seeing it in countries overseas, in Latin America, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, countries that are starting to challenge this so-called free market global capitalist model. So that is the first thing I'd like to clarify. Capitalism isn't about free markets. It's about its priority is accumulating capital. Now, in this process, as you mentioned, I've argued that it's genocidal. In this process, it is inherently violent, and I'm talking specifically here about structural violence. Obviously, there's other forms of violence. We use our militaries to further corporate interests overseas. But It's also structural violence is inherent in the capitalist system. By structural violence, I mean that there's inequalities that are built into the system that cause mass suffering and misery and death on a genocidal scale of people who cannot access their basic fundamental needs because of society's structures. For example, in Europe, Europeans spend $11 billion a year on ice cream. For $9 billion a year, everyone in the global south could have safe drinking water and sanitation. But the logic of capital compels people, investors, to produce ice cream for people in Europe who have disposable income to buy ice cream. There's profit in that. There's not profit in providing health care for poor people in the global south who cannot pay for it. So as a result, we have over 10 million people a year dying in the global south of preventable and treatable diseases. And this is structural violence, because we have the capacity, the knowledge, the wealth, the resources to ensure everyone's basic needs are met. But we don't. Capital produces for those who have disposable income to spend on whatever, and not for those whose necessities are lacking. So that is structural violence. And I argue that this is occurring on such a scale that it's genocidal. As you mentioned, since 1995, when the WTO came into being, we're talking over 150 million people have died unnecessarily from the structural violence inherent in capitalism.
Let's just interject here. Let me put a very personal face on this of how it happens in just one area. Let's say that you're a citizen living in a poor country, but you have natural resources. So even though you're financially poor, you're able to have gardens and barter and exchange and community cooperatives with other people. And therefore, you have your basic needs met. And then along comes corruption within most of the hierarchical government structures. And they see an opportunity working with members from the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund or the Bank of Development to put in a new hydroelectric dam or put in a major road that happens to go right to the rubber forest or to oil fields. And they have to have a new dock in order to get that because the sea lanes won't allow the type of tankers in there without running aground or ending up on the reefs. So you end up getting $2 billion. And then this is a part of what's called structural adjustment. None of the country is going to be able to pay that back, but you're paying interest, and the interest can compound. So $2 billion can become $4 billion, can become $6 billion. So then in comes a person who says, here's what we're going to do. In order to pay this back, we're going to see that you have your fuel that you give the people each month, you give them some subsidies, get rid of that. We're going to put in a road, but this road's going to be a toll road. If anyone goes on the road, they're going to have to pay a private corporation. We're going to have a public-private partnership. That dock is going to have docking fees by all the other ships, cruise ships, or cargo ships come in there. Now, you've been having all this farmland, which has really just been of no value except to the native population. We see you doing a cash crop. We're going to do cocoa, we're going to do bananas, or we're going to do coconut. We're going to do something that we can grow and then ship out, even fish farms. And also, and then they start taking all the private industries. And before long, the people in power, because they're all so bribed, one of the people that bribed them and threatened them was a person who was a guest on this show. He wrote the book, Confessions of Being Economic Hitman, Perkins, John Perkins. And he said, I would go in and meet with the president of a country, or I would meet with the prime minister of a country. And I would say, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to be able to put money into a Swiss bank account. You're going to be able to, in time, spend time in the French Riviera. Buy yourself a beautiful mansion, $10, $20, $30 million. You'll be able to go to Monte Carlo. Everything you ever wanted. You want a fleet of exotic cars? We can get it for you. But in turn, we want you to, and then suddenly their budget has to go for military supplies. This was the case in Greece, where the highest single line item in the debt each year for almost a decade and a half was the military budget. Well, why in the world would Greece need two submarines and advanced missile systems and all this other arms? It didn't. But the people who are corrupt in the Department of Defense and procurement work with German firms and made that happen. And then that's one of the reasons that they had to crash, because they had all this debt and the rich weren't paying their taxes, and they had created an imbalance in their whole economy. In any case, now we're in Africa, and a guy's being told, think of all you can have, private jet, but we must have the privatization rights to gold, to silver, to oil, to gas, to bauxite, etc. And we can package it so it looks like it's a development to help your country. And indeed, we'll do some things. And the person says no. And then he says, you don't want to say no. Because if you do, you will not see it coming. You go up one day and your plane will drop out of the sky. You end up having a heart attack, but it won't be a natural heart attack. You get hit or drowned. It'll happen to you, I promise. And he said, with rare exception, that's what happened, and they would say yes. There were a handful that said no, and they were killed, assassinated by our CIA. So now the poor people in this country that were able to have, with low capital, they still had a standard of living that allowed them to survive. Now their land is taken away in major land grab that's going on today. Now they're no longer getting the subsidies in peanut oil or whatever oil it was, or any other food, rice. So now they're on their own. Well, now they can't create agriculture that'll work, so they migrate to the cities and become a part of the massive slum. And with that comes crime and drugs and prostitution. And instead of ever being honest about the underlying cause, structural adjustment, we say, well, these people are lazy, and all they need is more free market, and let the free market architects in there, and it'll all change. No, it was the free market that caused this. And even in the original $2 billion, 90% of that never goes into a country. It always stays in the host countries. It'll go to their engineering firms, their consulting firms. Massive corruption, massive, on a scale that's almost unimaginable, into the hundreds of billions of dollars they have made. So that is something that we never talk about, because if we did, we'd have to ask about the World Bank and the corrupt little pathetic organization it is, the International Monetary Fund, and some of these other institutions that supposedly get a good name and a good reputation, none of which is deserved. Your thoughts, please.
No, exactly. And you hit on the core issue there, and that is displacement of people from the land. 3.5 billion people, half the world's population, still make their living on the land. And as you said, traditionally, they've been subsistence producers selling in local markets, and they could meet their basic necessities. They're poor by our standards in the global north, but they could meet their basic necessities. And soon as these conditions are imposed on these governments by, you know, economic hitmen like John Perkins or the IMF, the World Bank, all playing the same role, then we open up these economies, are opened up so that our corporations can go in and access all these resources on favorable conditions. Coal, oil, gold, coltan, whatever it is. And of course, then they need access to land for that. And so what we do is we create conditions to where the peasants and farmers can't survive. And as you said, they end up being forced off their lands and head to the cities, where they now serve a useful purpose for the capitalist system, because they now become the huge army of surplus labor that keeps wages cheap for the manufacturing jobs that we're moving from the global north to the global south. Because as long as most of the peasant population in Africa and Europe, Africa and Latin America and Asia can subsist off the land, they don't need jobs. So if we're going to move all this manufacturing to the global south, where we can pay $2 an hour or less, then we need a surplus labor force to keep those wages down. And that's what the displaced farmers serve. Meanwhile, corporations take over their land. We use it for exporting foods back to us here in the global north so we can consume it. We use it now to grow food crops for biofuels or agrofuels, as I call them. And we use that land to access oil, coal, and other minerals that, again, we need for our electricity, for our automobiles, and everything else. So and now Vandana Shiva would say that these people have gone from materialistically poor by our standards to truly poor as they now scramble to survive, whether it's digging through garbage dumps for something to sell on the streets in the informal economy, or as you mentioned, they get into crime. But they become desperate. They get into human trafficking. They become so-called illegal immigrants trying to get to a wealthy nation to survive. So this process destroys sustainable subsistence living that provides them with the basic necessities and turns them into desperately poor individuals struggling to survive. And I remember 1989 it was, I was in Ecuador in the Amazon, and I was traveling down the river through the rainforest there, and I came across an indigenous village. And it was one of the most depressing places I'd ever been. It was mostly abandoned. There's about five families there. And I talked to one of the men there, and I said, what happened to everyone? And he told me they left about a year ago. He said, when the oil company left. I said, really? He said, yes, they've gone to the cities. All these indigenous people have gone to the cities in Ecuador now, trying to recapture the modern world they had a taste of during the 15 years the oil company was there. He said, the oil company came, told us we no longer had to continue with our traditional ways. We no longer had to gather food in the forest or fish or hunt, that they would bring in everything we need on their boats if we worked for them. And they worked for them for 15 years. The oil ran out. The oil company left. And now all the land, the streams, the rivers are all polluted with oil. They can't return to their traditional way of life. And they've had a taste of the so-called modern life, but they can't continue with that anymore. So now they're stuck between two worlds. They've been devastated by, the logic of capital. These corporations coming in, destroying the livelihoods of people to extract resources for profit and to maintain our lifestyle in the north, because we all play a role as consumers in this. We're told that we need four or five planet Earths for everyone to live like people in the United States live. And, of course, we only have one planet Earth. So the logical conclusion there is that we are consuming someone else's share of the Earth's resources. And that's what we're doing. We're consuming the resources throughout the global south at a prolific rate. And if we're consuming at that rate, that means there's millions of people, tens of millions of people, who cannot meet their basic needs because we're consuming their resources. And our corporations are profiting hugely by providing us with those resources.
You're familiar with Jerry Mander, aren't you?
Yes.
From the International Forum on Globalization. He was on this program, and he stated that because capitalism's goal is to accumulate wealth, but not to distribute wealth. And I think that that is the biggest lesson to learn of the mistake we make when we believe people like Sean Hannity and others who say, just go out and accumulate wealth or participate with people who accumulate wealth or take away all the roadblocks to accumulate wealth, and somehow it'll benefit everyone. I don't see it benefiting everyone, and it hasn't benefited everyone. And there's a strong proclivity to wage war in order to constantly have resources to sustain its growth. I have a very strong feeling about the synergies between the globalization of capital and the expansion of militarism to protect capitalist interest. And I see this even today when the United States and New Zealand are participating in war games out there, and also in Australia the same way, as if somehow this is to be defensive when it's actually not defense, it's to be offensive against China. And if you've been to China, you know that they have 16 of the 20 largest cities in the world. They have, in all reality, they have the largest mineral resources in the world, 90%. They have the largest gold collection in the world, both buying and mining. They have they are right up there with the United States in energy use, but they also have 49% to 57% savings of their citizens. They have iron hand of the old Communist Party, who are now not communists. They're just, you know, they're just greedy sociopathic ideologues, like most people with power. And they have forgotten about their environment until now. It's a little late catching up, but almost 30% of the entire country of China is now engaged in desertification. They're losing thousands of miles of desert to the desert per week, and it may be stoppable. 27,000 rivers in China now no longer run. They're so polluted and can't be used. So they've got a mess. And if you go in and see how bad it is, then you're shocked by it. But the other side of it is you're also shocked by how well they've done many things. So they have this paradox. They do not tolerate dissent. They do not allow freedom of speech, and they do not allow the freedoms we express in this country. And yet, on the other hand, they are now surpassing the United States, and will probably surpass the United States in the next 3 to 4 years, in what they're able to do. And they also have the alliance of Russia, India, Iran, Brazil, and South America. And also they have an alliance with 22 Central and South American countries that no longer want to use the dollar as the reserve currency. So when you have that many major nations that no longer want to use the dollar as reserve currency, it's not, is the dollar gone as the reserve currency in the near future? It's when, and I believe it'll happen overnight. I believe people go to bed one night and wake up the next morning, and suddenly the dollar is no longer the reserve currency, and then we're going to panic, because buying more dollars back, or printing more dollars, or, you know, buying more bonds will not make a difference to the Fed, because everybody recognizes the Fed is just a corrupt fiat currency creator at that point. Then we're in free fall. Where we go from there, no one knows. So that's, I hope I'm wrong on all those things. But why in the world would the United States be posturing, as it has, against both Russia and trying to get a missile defense system outside of Poland and Czechoslovakia, and this whole stupid idea of let's surround China, when China is so sophisticated that we could not possibly win a battle against China. Look, we can't even win after 11 years against frequently illiterate individuals who are not terrorists. They're merely angry because we've entered their territory and entered their home and disrupt their lives and punish them in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Neither have we won. But then again, we didn't win in Vietnam. Now, all of these are, in effect, nothing more than peasant revolutions, in counterinsurgency revolution. They're pushing back against us in whatever way they know. We're talking about China now. That's an altogether different can of worms. There, they have a lot to lose by having war. They're not about to see all that they build up be destroyed. And we have to ask ourselves, are we willing to destroy the world over a system of capitalism and the neocons that run that, out of some stupid notion that somehow we must regain our position? Your thoughts on any of this, please? And did any of the things I just say make sense from your perspective?
Yes, they did. And I want to touch on a few of them, because the military-industrial complex is a perfect example of the functioning of the logic of capital and the resulting structural violence. For example, every 3 seconds, a child younger than 5 dies unnecessarily in the world. And yet in those same 3 seconds, $120,000 are spent on military armaments worldwide. And this is because the military-industrial complex, especially in the United States, because it's by far the largest industry military funding in the world, but it follows the logic of capital. It's a huge corporate welfare program that allows these corporations to accumulate massive profits and capital. Lockheed Martin, 70% of its revenues come from military contracts with the U.S. government. It exists almost exclusively to take taxpayer dollars and build weaponry. And this logic drives the U.S. military growth, and you know, it again is profit driven. So it's, I would say it's not necessarily that anyone is in control and strategizing exactly how we deal with China militarily. It has just its own logic in constantly expanding because it is part of the capitalist system, and it takes taxpayer dollars to do it. So that is a huge problem with regard to the system. And again, it's people, millions dying from structural violence while we spend this money on weapons, insane weapons that ultimately could, as you said, could destroy us all. And China is another fascinating example of the logic of capital. As you said, it's now a capitalist nation. Even it's a dictatorship. It's repressive, as was Pinochet in Chile, the testing ground for the modern free market, so-called free market system. China is very similar. And the problem is its rapid industrialization is following the same path as historic capital development, the Industrial Revolution in Britain and in the U.S. were both fueled or driven by fossil fuels, coal, and then later oil. And this is what China's doing. As you mentioned, we've got an ecological disaster in China. And again, this is contributing to climate change and who knows what kind of genocide in the future as a result of this. But the other thing that China's showing us is that 200 million people in China have achieved middle-class status. Now, that's only 6% of the 3 billion people who live in poverty in the world. And yet, just elevating that 6% to middle-class status, to the lifestyle of the average person in the global north, has put huge pressure on the Earth's resources, on the environment in the form of climate change. And so this dream, this is an impossible dream that we're pitching to 7 billion people in the world, that if you accept free markets, if you accept the capitalist model, then you can live like we do in the global north. And yet only 6% of the poor in the global south being raised to live like we do, and the earth is being stretched to its limits already, our natural resources and our environment. So it's a lie that the whole world can live like us. Again, you need 4 or 5 planet Earths for 7 billion people to live like we do. But it's a lie that we have to convince everyone in the world to buy into. Otherwise, we can't access these resources that we need a disproportionate amount of, and our corporations want to generate profits. And this is where the military comes in. The military-industrial complex serves two roles. One, generate profits as part of the capitalist system itself. And the other, as you said, is the U.S. military is crucial for protecting and furthering the interests of U.S. corporations and other multinational corporations around the world to ensure they can access these resources to generate the profits. And so it's intrinsically linked to capitalism, as you notice, the military expansion with capitalist expansion. And we're addicted to growth. Again, it's a growth economy. And as you said, it doesn't tell us how this wealth is redistributed. This is why capitalists focus on GDP. So we keep hearing how wealthy we are, how good the economy is doing. It grew 3%, 5% last year. Our GDP is increasing. Well, that just tells us the amount of wealth in our nation. It tells us nothing about how it's distributed. Because if we focused more on that, we'd have more people responding as we saw the Occupy movement responding, because that wealth is being distributed in a very unequal manner, and the rich are getting richer, both within countries and between countries. And so we've got to get away from this addiction to growth and the belief that growth and more production and more wealth will benefit everyone and trickle down, because we've learned now after 30 years it's not trickling down sufficiently, and it cannot trickle down sufficiently. The earth cannot sustain 7 billion people living like we do.
Right now, the U.S.'s darling in Latin America is Colombia, which at one time was the third largest recipient of U.S. military aid, in large part to fight the cocaine and drug trade. And some would argue that Colombia has been on the path towards becoming an American colony wherein multinational corporations have secured a large percentage of the nation's oil, coal, and gold. It is perhaps the least benevolent to its citizens, as other countries are in South America. So could you explain to us how the Colombian drug trade has served the capitalist agenda in the past, and what have been the long-term consequences, not only in the drug industry, but in the destabilization of the region? And then from there, take us up to Mexico's failed efforts, spurred on by our DEA and our war on drugs, where over 70,000 Mexicans have died in just the last 8 years from their failed war on drugs. In fact, everywhere in the world, the war on drugs has failed when it's been based upon a punish the person using the drugs or distributing the drugs or growing the drugs. And I think back to Prohibition. That's how we got Lucky Luciano, and that's how we got La Cosa Nostra, and then the Mafia, and then all the different families. It was because of Al Capone. It was because of the Prohibition. Keep something that people want away from them, make it illegal, and there'll be people in the black market who will supply it. Then we'll moralize about it as if somehow this is a defect in their character or spirituality or social contract by using these substances. Well, if that's the case, then why didn't you, you know, ban cigarettes? Why don't you ban alcohol again? Because why don't you ban fast foods? Why don't you ban sugar? And so we become paradoxically inane on this. We live with the oxymoron that we'll do one thing with something that is bad, but not do anything with something else that's even worse. And then we say we're having a war on it. And every time we've had a war on anything, war on poverty, war on crime, the war on cancer, we lose these wars. We're nowhere near a victory on any of them. Take us through this, please.
Well, yeah, Colombia is a fascinating study because it shows you how creative the U.S. can be in promoting global capitalism. Because much of Latin America had a huge debt crisis in the 80s, which Colombia didn't experience. And so, unlike the other countries, which were then the IMF and the World Bank and the economic hitmen came in and forced them to open up their economy and their resources to foreign corporations, foreign investors, Colombia, they didn't have that leverage over Colombia. But what the leverage they did have was the drug war. And so the U.S. gave Colombia the aid it needed and wanted to fight the drug cartels in the 90s, late 80s and early 90s, and George Bush Sr. put conditions on that aid requiring that Colombia open up its economy or start opening up its economy. But also another thing happened in the 90s as Colombia implemented these economic restructuring is that unemployment skyrocketed all of a sudden. Misery was increasing, and the FARC guerrilla group, the Marxist guerrilla group in Colombia, increased in strength. So by the end of the 90s, it was a serious threat to the Colombian government. So the U.S. switched its focus on the drug war away from the cartels, the big cartels, and shifted it to the guerrillas. It used the drug war as the way to sell U.S. military intervention in Colombia to the Congress and the American people. And this was a military implementation of neoliberalism in Colombia, because now they could go after the peasants who grow the coca instead of the trafficking organizations, which means they could now go into the countryside and start displacing peasants. And the strengthened Colombian military slowly regained rural regions, control of them. And immediately, over the last 10 years, as this territory became under government control, the foreign investors came pouring in to take advantage of the new favorable investment conditions. Colombia is now the number one foreign supplier of coal to the United States and one of the top 12 oil suppliers, and those are its two leading exports now. It used to be coffee. And 82% of the investment in Colombia over the last decade has been in oil and mining. And it's being pointed to as a neoliberal poster child. And at the same time, the production of cocaine has diminished. So it's being held up as this drug war success, whereas what the drug war actually did in Colombia was militarily implement these so-called free market capitalist policies that opened up the country's resources to our multinationals. Now, what happened to the drugs? Well, more coca cultivation and cocaine processing shifted across the borders to Peru and Bolivia, and in place of the Colombians, the Mexican cartels came to be the dominant force in international drug trafficking. They supplanted the defeated Colombian cartels, and they now control the international trafficking of cocaine. And so this is aided in part by NAFTA, another so-called free market agreement, right, free trade agreement. Because the massive flow of goods across the Mexican border now has made it the easiest way to get cocaine into the United States. So the Mexican drug cartels now control that trade. And what our so-called drug war success in Colombia has done is simply shift the violence, the drug violence, from Colombia to Mexico. So Colombia only looks like a drug war success if you look at it with blinders on. If you take those blinders off and look at the region as a whole, we still got just as much drug violence. We just shifted it to Mexico. Meanwhile, in Colombia, it's one of the only countries in South America in the last 10 years to see inequality increase. So while its booming economic growth is being held up as a shining example of capitalist development, inequality has got worse and worse again in that country. Now, Mexico is now enduring all of this violence, and NAFTA has displaced 2 million Mexican farmers because we flooded the Mexican markets with subsidized corn, U.S. agribusinesses have, displacing all these farmers off their land again, the trend that capitalism has followed for 300-400 years. And these farmers now are desperate for work. And well, NAFTA hasn't created anywhere near enough manufacturing jobs to provide livelihoods to these displaced farmers. So they become engaged in criminal activities, including the drug trade. Moreover, they flood across the border to the U.S. and are now perceived as the so-called illegal immigration problem because they are desperate to find a way to survive. Before 1994, before NAFTA, there were only 4.8 million Mexican-born people living in the U.S. That's all throughout the 20th century. Within 5 years of that, it doubled to 9 million as Mexicans poured over the border, even though the free trade agreement didn't allow the free movement of people, only goods and profits. And so, you know, the drug war, the implementation of free trade agreements and opening up of these economies to multinational companies in Colombia, in Mexico, have all had the same consequences: growing inequality, violence, and massive movements of people, displaced peasants internally off their lands, and massive immigration as people flood to the wealthy nations. And we're seeing it in Europe, too, with people flooding there from Africa, and in Australia, people from Asia. Every wealthy nation now is contending with all of these so-called illegal immigrants whose subsistence lifestyles that provide them with their basic needs for hundreds of years have been destroyed by predatory capitalism. And we don't want to now deal with the immigrants when we caused this crisis in the first place.
I have one final question for you for our program today, and that is that some argue that the descent into fascism is a sign of capitalism's breakdown. And the current economic crisis that erupted in 2007 and 2008 clearly exposed capitalism's structural weaknesses in the free market system. And since then, we have been experiencing increasing draconian policies by developed governments to impose austerity measures on their populations to compensate for the failures of the banking and corporate elite. And now we are hearing more frequently from journalists and scholars that some countries, the U.S. in particular, is transforming into a new kind of fascist police state. Control and censoring of the press, internet, the militarized role of the domestic landscape, uncontrolled surveillance and spying on citizens, labeling anyone opposing the current political regime as terrorist and enemies of the state, such as environmentalists opposing the administration's fossil fuel stand. Even worse is corporate spying and private intelligence on citizens sanctioned by the government. Therefore, when capitalism reaches its apex and begins its decline, in what ways does fascism then become capitalism's next option to continue its reign and control, and how fascism then, a natural consequence of capitalism's structural weaknesses, manifest? And do you believe that fascist characteristics emerge from a politically charged corporate elite, or in your view, is it a natural development that unfolds due to certain historical conditions that fall into place to accommodate its emergence?
Well, I believe it's somewhat natural. I would argue under capitalism, I would argue that we're already entering the fascist stage and have been increasingly so over the last couple of decades. And it becomes more and more evident with each crisis, and the crisis in capitalism are coming more frequently now. We have this corporate elite, this corporatocracy, if you will, who our government serves, and it is this corporatist system that is totally focused on, or almost exclusively focused on, growth and generating profits for corporations. And as the system starts to break down, as we saw in 2008, we saw who the government responded to: the investment banks, the audit companies, not the people who had lost their homes and everything. And I think this is an inevitable conclusion of capitalism, this concentration of power in a small elite. And in a liberal democracy, that elite, these economic elite, these corporations, have a disproportionate political influence over policies. And so policies, not surprisingly, serve their interests. And then as it breaks down more and more, then they desperately want to hold on to their position of privilege. So we see systems, we see the Patriot Act, we see the PRISM, the intelligence, the surveillance, everything is used under the name of either protecting us from terror or crime or whatever, but ultimately it's to ensure that this elite maintain their control over the system. And as it crumbles, that control will become more desperate and will become even more fascist. Now, when the system actually finally implodes, which I think inevitably will at some point, you touched on it with regard to the U.S. and the dollar being the international currency and stuff, in one way or another, it's going to start imploding. Now, the question is, what comes afterwards? Rosa Luxemburg, 100 years ago, said it's either socialism or barbarism. And I think it is one of those two. But we could go through intensifying fascism on the way. And by socialism, I don't mean the Soviet model of authoritarian socialism. I would call what's going on in Latin America a more true socialism. And again, think of the two words, capitalism and socialism. Capital is the priority of that economic system, to generate capital for those who own it. Socialism, the reason it's called socialism, is because it's about the social well-being of everyone. And a system should serve people. A system that prioritizes the social being of everyone is what we should want, not one that prioritizes capital accumulation that may or may not meet everyone's basic needs. And I think that the 21st century socialism that's occurring in countries like Venezuela is introducing a participatory democracy. Power has been moved over the last 10 years down to the community levels, through communal councils, through worker-owned cooperatives. And you're seeing more grassroots control over lives. People have much more meaningful voice over the decisions that impact their lives. Whereas we look at the United States, it's going the opposite direction. As we become increasingly fascist, our system is becoming increasingly elitist and elite control to serve the interests of capital.
Gary, thank you very much for coming on and sharing these insights. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure people listening have as well.
Thank you for having me, Gary.
Gary Leech, GarryLeech.com is the website. The book is Capitalism, a Structural Genocide. This has been a continuation of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, and you're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all very much.